Hello, guys, and welcome to the Life School for Men podcast. We meet here weekly at the intersection of scriptural wisdom and 21st century life for men. It's here that we'll have intelligent conversations, conversations about the issues that guys just like you and I face in everyday life. So get ready, ready to laugh, ready to think, and ready to learn. It's on now. First thing, and this, honestly, there's going to be a lot here, so make sure that you take time to go through the notes later on. I may miss some things, and we might go through some things a little hurriedly. Here's the first big idea. Before you can appeal to someone, before you can motivate them, before you can inspire them, or ask them to press on when things are difficult, you have to know that something is in them already that you can appeal to. So have you ever tried to motivate a child with adult thoughts? This would be good for you. This is actually the right thing to do. Have you ever tried to motivate a coworker with something and they were just not there yet? They didn't really care about the work, they didn't care about the process, they didn't care about something, and therefore your appeals to a higher level of something fell on deaf ears. And so here's the leadership principle that we all need to remember. To lead people is a slow process. If you attempt to take people on a journey but have not prepared them for why they're going on the journey and why it will matter, you're going to lose people along the way. And so every leader needs to spend a significant amount of time building into people the things that he or she will later appeal to. So for instance, you can't appeal to a sense of noble responsibility if you haven't first built that sense of noble responsibility into them. You can't appeal to a sense of sacrifice if they don't sense the value first of sacrifice. And you can already sense how slow this process will be then. And think about this in work. Do leaders actually know in your workplace, do they actually know what motivates you? Do they spend any time building into you an understanding of what the organization is about? Why it matters that we do what we do here? And what's lost if we don't do that thing? Because if not, when they later on appeal to you to sacrifice for the good of the organization, what's your response? I don't even know what we're about. Why would I sacrifice for that? I've got enough things I could give my life to, let alone sacrifice for this business. Well, the same is true in family. The same is true in anything else that you lead. So ask yourself this question every time you look at people. Do they have inside of them the thing that I'm appealing to? And how do I know that? Have I installed that in them? All right. So let's think about this from... let's just go over to the book of Nehemiah. It's a good place to look at that. And we've looked at this one appeal already. It's in the second chapter of Nehemiah. And if you don't want to turn there, that's fine. I can read it. This is Nehemiah. He's speaking to the people. He's speaking to the people after he has gone out and inspected the wall, but before they have begun any work. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be a disgrace." What makes that a compelling appeal?
I feel like a disgrace now. I feel like a disgrace now.
Nehemiah will only be able to use that as an appeal if he already senses that the people feel a sense of shame, a sense of inadequacy, that there are people without a real clear home. He can't appeal to that if they don't feel disgrace. And so it's like if you appeal to your children's sense of pride in the fact that they have a clean room, but they don't really care if they have a clean room, that was a wasted effort. Right? You appealed to something that wasn't yet in them. So return to the text. You see the trouble we are in. All right, they could identify with that. Jerusalem lies in ruins. Its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be a disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. All right, now by this time, there's something that the people themselves must have been asking. Has God left us stuck in this mess? You know, this has been, remember we talked about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago now, the lengthy period of time that this took, how long it took just to the altar. Building the altar went quickly. Establishing the foundation for the rebuilding of the temple around the altar went fairly quickly, but then everything more or less fell apart. And decades went by while they struggled to make traction on this. And they met opposition, human opposition. And then a generation would go by, and more human opposition. And at what point in time do these people start to say, I wonder if this is really what God has in mind after all? Because what's the question that we all ask ultimately when our good work in service to God meets opposition? What's the question we all ask in one form or another? Is it worth it? And is God really in this? Because we think, rightly or wrongly, that if God is in it, God should be behind it.
And there will be difficulty, it won't be slow, or it will just be smooth and great if God's in it.
And honestly, from a human rationale, doesn't that make sense? I mean, can't God do? Can't God provide? Shouldn't God provide? Here I am stuck in this thing. And so Nehemiah appeals to what is undoubtedly a major question here when he says, and I told them about the gracious hand of God upon me and what the king had said to me. And so Nehemiah says, look, there are so many things that work together that it seems improbable that work together to cause me to be here now, that I have no conclusion to draw but that it was the gracious and favorable hand of God that was on me that made this possible. So don't despair. The answer to your question is yes, God is still in this work even though it feels difficult. All right, turn over to the fourth chapter. All right, and we're going to start at the 10th verse. This is a little bit longer. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, and they've already begun to build, the strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall. Now, here's the paradox of what they're trying to do, and I don't know if we've spent time doing this before. All right, so let's say that when it's finished, the wall is going to be this high. So it says that they're at about the halfway point. All right, so what does it take to get all this rubble, which represents those are stones, throwing a square one there. What does it take to get that pile of rubble into an organized inner and outer wall? We're going to fill it with some dirt and stuff like that so that we have a reinforced wall. How much work does it take to do that? It does, doesn't it? Because they're not even starting. It's not like the building supply truck pulled up to the job site and dumped off a large supply of cinder blocks and bricks. They've got to pick through a pile of rubble, pick out the good stones. They've got to test the stones because it says, especially anywhere there was wood, that the stones were burnt. And stone, after it's been heated super hot, can become brittle. So they've got to not only go through the stones to find the good stones and dig them out of the dirt, but they've also got to test which stones are good and which ones aren't. And they've got to build an inner, and that, well, okay, an outer and an inner wall, and fill it. They're halfway up. And what do they say? This is hard work and we are tired. What's the paradox in that? Think carefully. What's the paradox of that?
It's to rebuild a city for them.
No, here's the paradox. This is the easy part because this is the low level. They already sense that the higher up they go, they don't have cranes, they don't have material handlers. They've got to lift these stones by hand. Now, what is your natural instinct when you're selecting something in the way of stone to build? It's to find the good ones first. They've got to go deeper into the pile of clutter to get the good stones that they're going to take and lift higher up. They're halfway and they're tired. So when you look at that, don't let those couple of words slip by. There's a great deal of anguish being expressed there.
It's usually when we get tired halfway. We've got to get the rubble out of our lives, clear it out, or else we don't get things built.
The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall. Also, our enemy said, before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them, and we will kill them and put an end to the work. All right, so if exhaustion doesn't get you, fear might. And so now you see the job of the leader at this point. Remember, Nehemiah is one guy. He didn't come to build the wall. He came to supervise the building of the wall, to participate himself, but he's only one guy. Sense the desperation in this. Feel Nehemiah's challenge in this. He has to convince people who are starting to feel fatigue. And think in your own life. What does it feel like when you believe you have given your all and there's still half to do? And on top of that, now you're threatened. Maybe your family is threatened because of the work you're doing. What are you going to feel like? And this is why a couple of weeks ago we said that in many cases everything does rise or fall in leadership, because what was the leader's job? To convince this people that were ready to quit that they could keep doing this.
So you have natural opposition, you have spiritual opposition. Fatigue. Are you going to do things with
God? All right. Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us. Okay, so look at the three things now. There's three forms of opposition. The first is the natural situation here. It's a tough bill. The second thing is they've got enemies, and the enemies are threatening to kill them. And the third thing is the people that are supposed to be their friends are saying, you know what, maybe we ought to just quit on this, because you've gotten threats from inside and threats from outside. Maybe it would be a better idea to let another generation handle this job. Therefore, I stationed some people behind the towers, the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. Well, now, isn't that interesting? Now, how many of you are in the building trades in one form or another? You are, okay. Do you generally show up for work with your gun? Well, I don't want to know. Never mind. Is a gun considered one of the tools of your trade in a routine basis? No. Okay, let's hope it stays that way. But what was this asking them to be? See, now he's not only... Remember, these are just common folk. Okay, they earn their living doing farming. Now, admittedly, this is not sophisticated work. Digging and shoveling and stacking and all that. It's not like it takes an engineer's degree to do this, but this isn't what they do.
They weren't doing it before.
Right. And now, not only do they have to do this work that is difficult and they're unfamiliar with, but now they have to feel like they're soldiers too. So when we read this, it's easy to just slide by all these details and minimize the value of Nehemiah's influence on the people here. Okay, so again, I stationed some people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers and your sons and your daughters, your wives, and your homes." All right, now let's search this appeal for what's already in them that Nehemiah can rely on. Because remember, if they quit now, it's probably over. Just remember that. If they quit now, it's over. What is he hoping to find within them that he can appeal to? Because this is my secret and your secret when we wish to lead people. Go ahead.
It's their hope.
Okay.
You station them by families. I'll fight harder for my family than I will anything.
Okay, so right there is one good point. Is there anything else?
They know they have God behind them.
Okay. He's reminding them of that again. Anything else?
The reminder, this is a God project. This is just not about us. That reminder again. He's with us, yeah.
When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. So there's a respite. It looks like this day of disaster has been forestalled. We can get back to work. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. So what was his strategy there?
Split the work in half.
So that for every man that was building, there's a man watching. For every man that's building, there's a man that's protecting. So now what do you feel like? Somebody has my back. And quite literally, somebody has my back. Because I don't have eyes in the back of my head. What are your thoughts right now? What principles do you personally take away from this that can help you in your situation to influence whatever sort of leadership you're doing? What do you see there that can help you?
You've got to be willing to defend a brother. You've got to be willing to accept that he would defend you.
That's at the ground level, but what about from Nehemiah's level? Remember, we're talking about this not from the experience of the man that's stacking the stones. We're talking about this from Nehemiah's perspective. What do you and I need to learn that we can see here?
Well, I think it is kind of important about the stacking of stones, because in Nehemiah, he's not asking to do anything that he hasn't done or is willing to do.
There's one thing. Okay, so I need to demonstrate to my people that I am willing to do the things that I'm calling on them to do. Even if, and remember, Nehemiah has other things to do. Right? In order for him to travel around the wall and check in on all of the places where work needs to be done and see if there's any problems, he can't stay stuck stacking stones at one place. Wow, there was a lot of S's in that sentence. But he has to demonstrate that he's able to. And all of us have fallen prey to this as a leader, right? I resort to starting to do what I'm asking others to do, and pretty soon I'm doing and no longer leading. What else?
If you're doing, you can lead by example, right?
Yes, you can. Anything else? Exactly. That is it. He is the one that is responsible for their safety. It is his plan that makes it possible for them to feel secure. So he doesn't minimize their natural human concerns about safety or the safety of their family. He addresses them. So if I have a mission, remember, his mission is get the wall built. What are the people thinking about? I'd like to get the wall built, but I don't want to lose my life in the process, and I also don't want to lose my family. So when I as a leader become so narrowly focused that my only mission is to get my work done, even if it's the people's work, but I disregard their personal concerns that may live outside of my mission, then I've probably lost half of them because their attentions are going to be distracted and divided. So rather than ignore that, he addresses it head on. Is there anything else? Isn't that good? Yeah. Even if it takes us longer, we will do this in a way that doesn't lose life. I suppose you could draw some safety conclusions about safety in the workplace right there, couldn't you?
Sounds OSHA.
What do you say?
Sounds OSHA.
But that's good. We're not stopping. We're going to keep going, but it's going to be slow. We're not stopping.
And it shows the enemy, too, that they have faith and hope. And it's got to be demoralizing to the enemy. You can't do these guys. We're threatening and they're still going.
Yep.
Greatly more demoralizing.
When they felt heard and cared for by leadership. Imagine if he just said, I told you to build the wall. Stop the whining. Get back to it. They'd have all left.
Now, incidentally, if we take this back, remember a number of weeks ago, we looked at Solomon's son when he took over leadership from Solomon. And some of the leaders, the older leaders, said to him, you should think about reducing the stress and the pressure on the people that you're going to lead. And they came to him and they said, if you will be kinder and easier on us, we'll serve you faithfully all of our lives. What was his response in the end? Full speed ahead. Whatever my dad did, we're going to double down on that. And I'm not really interested in what's convenient for you. We're going to build this empire up. And so in the process of trying to hurry and press ahead to build a great nation, he lost the people and ultimately lost the nation.
Yes.
So slow was better. Thank you. What are you smirking about?
I knew John had your 6. That was that Nehemiah verse 16.
Oh.
You build the wall, he's got your back.
There you go. Well, this is the weapon of choice here.
Definitely a sword.
All right. Jump down to the verse 19, I think. Then I said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, the work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. This is something that sometimes we forget. When I'm down in the dirt, laying stones and doing all this, I don't necessarily have the aerial view. This is Nehemiah's responsibility. It's not only to hear the people's concerns, but Nehemiah orchestrates a comprehensive plan. It's not just, okay, you guys protect your slice of the wall and they're going to protect their slice of the wall, but he says, if there is trouble anywhere in this entire construction project, blow the horn at that point and everyone will come to there. And what this does is indicate to us that Nehemiah is traveling the girth of the wall. He's checking in on every group and he's distributing this plan. He's going around and he's instilling confidence in the people. And again, I'll say this again, that sometimes you and I have the tendency, especially when we're new in leadership, to still feel like we need to be there doing the hands-on stuff every day, all the time. And in the process, we lose sight of the most important work that we have to do, which is to oversee something. And here's why this was a problem for me when I was younger. I was afraid that because what I heard from the people, figuratively speaking, on the wall, what I heard was, oh, look at him. He thinks he's so good he doesn't have to work anymore. Right? And we've all heard that. And so the implication is that the people who lead something really don't do important work, and the people who do important work don't need to be led. And that's the paradox. And you and I rise up out of the ranks of the common people and we rise to some position of leadership and we take that mentality with us and we still continue to stay focused on, I've got to be there doing the work because the people won't respect me if I'm not there doing the work. You need to set an example. But there's things that if you don't take the time to think through what the people need, and to go around and listen to the people, and then to develop important plans, if you don't take the time to do that, ultimately the people will continue to work, but their work won't be united. And it won't be as productive. And if you disagree with me right now, just meditate on that a while and put it to the test in some things that you have experienced in life.
Big Glenn, my dad told me that in his company, he climbed from the very bottom where he was fixing the machines all the way up now he's the vice president of the company. And some of the newer people, they see him walking around, they think he's just a big shot walking around with his iPad, checking on machines and everything. But he'll jump in once in a while, and he works at a yarn factory where they take thread and they weave it.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll set something up real quick and he'll be like, whoa! He'll let them know that, you know, it might look like I'm not working, but I know what I'm doing. I got to where I am.
Yep.
By doing what
you're doing. A good example. Yep.
That is. That's a really good example.
So he'll motivate them by jumping in and working with them once in a while.
Okay, next point. This is a good one. If I appeal to people to do something more, and you'll find it there, let's see, right after the Nehemiah verses. All right, let's just read it together. The increase of awareness without an increase in functional capability will build up a sense of helplessness or indifference. In other words, if I ask people to do more, if I ask them to do more at a higher level, and I am appealing to something that I know is in them, but I don't take into account the fact that they may need competency training, what am I asking from them? I'm asking them to do what they're not equipped to do, and they want to do it, but now they feel inadequate to do it. What does it feel like when you want to do something and feel inadequate? And just personalize this. What does it feel like when you know you should do something, you want to do something, you long to do something, but you don't know how to do it, and yet others are expecting you to do it? Anything else?
Frustrated.
Angry.
Angry.
That's a good one. Angry. Now, at the end of all of that, what do you do? You do. You quit. So this is another important leadership thing. I can be a great inspirer and motivator, but if I don't also equip people with the competencies that they need, I failed them, and in the end, they will become angry and bitter, just feel hopeless, they will feel lost, and they'll quit. It's the natural human condition. If I try to do things that I just don't seem to be able to figure out how to do, and nobody shows me how to do them, think about a complex task that you've had to do and tried to do it on your own and failed. And somebody came in and showed you. Your example was kind of good and ties in with that. Think about something you've tried to do, you don't know how to do, you want to do it, you really want to do a good job, but you just keep fumbling it up.
Another example would be, I grew up in a Catholic neighborhood, and all of my neighbor friends, they would say that they couldn't be what the church told them they could be, so they kind of gave up. They're like, I'm going to follow that rule, whatever, we just can't do it. So they kind of gave up on religion.
So, sometimes people need inspiration. Sometimes people need technical knowledge, and we've got to be able to provide that. And that doesn't mean, look, that doesn't need to live inside of you, because you as leader, I as leader, we don't always know the thing, how to teach the things that people need. We might need the very same things. I just have to be the source of that. I need to go out and find that. That's my mission at that point in time. All right. Next point, alignment versus agreement. Again, this is something that when you're new at any kind of leadership role, you're going to struggle with. It's not good to sit in a room and have people challenge your leadership because they don't agree with your plan. It feels awkward. It feels uncomfortable. Yet it's also necessary. Your mission isn't to squelch disagreement. Your mission is to bring all of the various points of view into play and into focus and form a comprehensive plan so that when you leave the discussion, there is alignment. Here's what you can't stand. Imagine, come back to the wall. Imagine if some of the people wanted to build the wall here and some of the people said, you know what, that is a really dumb idea. I think we should build the wall over here. Now that sounds absurd, I know. But in a smaller and subtler way, that's what happens when, after the discussions are over, we haven't established alignment. That's what happens. Just because people leave your presence doesn't mean they leave your presence agreeing with your plan. So give people time to express their ideas and their opinions, and don't just do it casually and indifferently. Really listen to what they have to say. You might learn some things that can improve the plan. But in the end, there has to be a sense of unity before you move ahead. Here's a different way of saying it. Don't attempt to move ahead until you've established some unity.
I think often in leadership, people look for uniformity and not unity. We don't value the differences that we have with those we're trying to lead, or to raise up the leadership ability that others have. And we miss that opportunity to really be unified.
The one thing that we've done with our leadership team, which is our board, all that, but when we do come to a decision, from this point on, it's a unified decision. You know, we're not discussing what if, should have, I didn't agree with that after that. We've got a great thing here where that hasn't happened, but that's something we can talk about. You know, we don't have to decide some of these things tonight. We can wait the next month, pray about that. But when we decide together, and we're all unified in that going forward.
All right, own the possibility of failure. I don't know.
That's good. That's true.
Here's the thing. If there is not the possibility, the distinct possibility of failing at something, if you're pretty confident that you can achieve this, then basically what you're doing is managing a result. You're not leading a result. And there's a big difference. Do you understand the difference? If I'm managing something, I'm taking what I know and the resources that are available to simply continue to press on with the current work. Managers manage what is. Leaders move toward what isn't yet. And by nature, anything that isn't yet implies a degree of unknown and a degree of uncertainty and the probability, or at least the possibility, that it could fail. So let's think for a moment, what are the number of ways that this wall building project could have failed? And what would have been the results? Actually, does anyone want to take notes on my drawing here?
Wish you were dead, that drawing. The biggest failure is they don't build the wall and the enemy wins. Kills them all.
Okay. Well, let's, that was a couple of different ones, so let's slow that down a little bit. Okay, so the first one is the project doesn't get done. Then you said the enemy wins. And then you said the enemy kills them. Okay, it's one thing to be a loser. It's another thing to be a dead loser. Would we agree?
The enemy winning could, that means Satan won, does it not?
It does. Okay, so even, there you go. So even if they are alive at the end, what is their theological viewpoint from that point on? What's their theology after that? Okay.
Basically, yeah. He can't be trusted. He's not faithful. He doesn't answer prayer, you know?
But here's the interesting thing. In order for their theology to remain intact, they had to act.
Well, they couldn't fail. If they failed themselves, they failed God, right? I mean, they just not built the wall then.
They failed themselves, they failed God. They not only failed themselves, they failed their progeny. They failed their kids who were 5 and 6 and 8 and 10 who still weren't building any wall, but they wouldn't have necessarily have a home. Or, if this happened, they wouldn't have a mom and a dad. Alright, so that's some of what's at stake. Now, how confident can they be that they can succeed? Do they know for a fact? Does Nehemiah know for a fact that they can succeed? Remember, Nehemiah, where does Nehemiah start this mission?
Way back.
1,000 miles away, sight unseen. He has yet to see this wall. And then he takes the nighttime tour and he takes a look at it. He's only been there, 3 days, it says. And then he goes out at night and he goes and surveys the wall. And it says, oh, go ahead.
If anybody thought that it could be done, it would be him. Because he's the one, obviously God thought he knew him. David had this job because he knew he was spiritually strong, I guess, correct? He's the leader. He's going to want, everyone else is going to want to quit. So, to me, it sounds like he knew it. This it was going to get done. He could do it.
Yeah, but what we see, our natural senses are powerful. You know, God told me, "Wow, look at this."
And when you read this, we should not dismiss the fact that, listen, we're all people. So I want you to think about something that you believe you should do. But it's 2:00 in the morning, and suddenly you're bolt awake because you're a little bit nervous about the fact that you're not so sure that you can do this, and you're starting to run through your head all the scenarios about what's going to happen, like these scenarios, if this job doesn't get done. And then you start to think about, and the difference between the job getting done and not getting done might be me, and I know that I've failed before, and I know that I've failed me before, and I know that I've failed other people before, and I'm the difference between success or failure.
But as a leader, he can't let them know
that. No, right, he cannot let them know that. But don't think that Nehemiah has no doubts, is totally confident, and every day he goes to sleep and says, it's going to be a great day tomorrow.
Well, then you start, right. Then he has to start to believe, and he does. God called me, God knows about all these details. He knows about all the opposition, naturally, the enemy, spirit, that's all stuff he takes into account, but it's not like, no problem. Yeah.
That's all those doubts are, right? It's just Satan trying to get in and saying, you can't do it.
Well, it is spiritual opposition, but it's also human opposition. And let's not even think that some of the people on his own side were not nervous about this. And asking him, are we sure this is a good idea? Should we stop now? Would here's another one. Would half a wall be better than none? Would half a wall be better than none?
Settle for good and miss God.
Okay, settle for good and miss God, or settle for good instead of settle for great?
Yeah.
Are we going to be proud in future generations because we did a half a job? Way to go, team.
How many times have you seen an empty field, lot, or acres, and a sign sitting there, future home of whatever, year after year? You know, what does that speak to there, you know?
Isn't that the importance of what they talk about in Exodus, about reminding kids of what God has done? And when our family gets together and we're facing a struggle or a trial, Vicky and I remind our kids, and this is a God who has healed Mommy and Vincent of epilepsy that the world said would never be healed. This is a God who has healed Vanessa of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis at the age of two, that the doctors who are not local doctors or Philly doctors, some of the best in the nation, tell us by 10 you'll be in a wheelchair and your arthritis will have you locked up and crippled. Here you are at 13, you know, tall as we are, playing, running, jumping. This is the God that we serve. This is why we do what we do. But if we don't remind our kids and remind ourselves of what He has done, we miss the future and the hope that He's promised us in Jeremiah.
And now, where does that start? That starts with the person who is leading. Right? Because the person who is... When you're... My stone wall is gone. I can't even point to it anymore. When you're...
Put it back from my notes.
When you're stuck here... You don't have the vision. That's important. That's another one of your roles. And one of the other things that you need to point out, or that you mentioned, but we can overlook it, is, see, he had to get, or she had to get, epilepsy in order to see God at work. You don't see God at work, and I'm not saying that the only way God can be visualized is to for us to have bad circumstances. But the bad circumstances often come before the deliverance, so we can't be surprised when the bad circumstances occur. Bad circumstances are part of a leader's material that he has to work with. But bad circumstances give God an opportunity to work and leverage in our lives.
I wasn't a believer when we went through that. I became a believer because of it. But this, the rubble was usable. It wasn't trash.
Isn't it good to have the rubble on the board?
It is, yes. Much better. I feel safe. But the world would say you've got this pile of stones. Nehemiah says we've got a wall. We just have to build it. We have to get there.
Yeah, that's good. I'm sure you also had a small group of people that refused to help because they didn't care.
Yeah, there's no question about it. That there would be a small core group that would be against it. No matter what you do, there's always going to be a handful of people, maybe even close to you, that are going to be against it.